This week's pundit is Eric Crampton, head of research at the Largely Libertarian New Zealand Initiative. Welcome back to Nights, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
You've been thinking about sugar.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a little bit. It's been in the news a fair bit
lately. Taxing the sweet stuff, a conservative government in Britain.
Yeah, that's a little surprising, but yeah. David Cameron had been in support of those kinds of things for rather some time. Bit disappointing that he went down that road, and I'm pretty glad that we are not following him down it.
Ah, well, I'll ask you about that a bit more in a moment. But my obvious first thought is, well, if we tax alcohol, but we don't ban it, mainly because we have decided as a society, and our representatives have decided that alcohol, a little bit of alcohol is not too harmful, mm-hmm. and too much is, so mm-hmm. we tax it. Shouldn't we do something like that with sugar? Because a little bit of sugar is fine, but too much sugar is going to make you sick, isn't it?
Well, the difference between alcohol and sugar on that one would be that if you consume far too much alcohol, you're likely to do harm to other people as well. You don't really see, besides toddlers out at birthday parties, people going on sugar rampages.
So I don't really. Right now, there's probably a lot of parents of toddlers who are thinking, yes, they do terrible harm. But then we still feed them that sweet stuff.
But it's not really a harm that you're going to be addressing very much through excise tax now, is it?
Is there evidence, however, that if we do tax people, if we tax sugar, it does reduce consumption?
Well, it depends what you mean by working in this kind of a case, so, or by effect. If you want to reduce the consumption of a taxed thing, you can do that. But you have to be aware that that might not be targeting quite what you're going after. So a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages can reduce consumption of those if the tax is high enough. But at the same time, people will just be shifting over into consuming other things. And that's one of the big differences that people miss between things like sugar and things like tobacco. So excise on tobacco has done a pretty good job in reducing consumption of tobacco products. If you think that's a good thing, then excise has worked towards that. Although it's the effects of excise increases have really been petering out over the last 5 years. When it comes to sugar, though, there's plenty of other things you can do. If the price of smokes goes up and you're addicted to nicotine, there aren't many other options for you out there. It's difficult to import vaping cartridges because you can't buy them domestically. You're kind of stuck. It's either quit or cut back a little bit, or, well, if you want nicotine, it's just cigarettes. If you've got a sweet tooth, though, and the price of sugar-sweetened beverages goes up, well, you might try fruit juices that don't have added sugar, so they often won't come under a tax, or switching into a brownie or a donut or some other kind of solid sugar, right?
Ah, but if we taxed all carbohydrates, so you couldn't do the substitution thing, it was all covered. So even your brownie or your donut or even a croissant, which has carbohydrates in it, would still get some sort of a levy.
Oh, sure. If you set it up that way, that would avoid those kinds of substitution problems. But people really overestimate the effects of these kinds of taxes because they look at evidence from these sort of one-offs, right? So if you're looking at how much people respond to a change in the price of soda with a tax or just natural changes in prices, and look at changes in consumption, they'll then extrapolate from that to, well, if we put a tax on everything, this would be the effect that we'd have on consumption. But that's just really wrong. Think about it just in terms of your own shopping habits. If you go out to the grocery store and Coke is on special this week, maybe you're going to pick up that 24-pack for $18 because that's a pretty good price. You'll drink it over the next 3 weeks. If a researcher was looking at your shopping habits based on scan data out of the supermarket, they'd say, well, you're really price responsive. Hike the price a little bit and you're buying none of it. But a price cut and it's on special, you're buying tons. So therefore, if we put on a tax, people's consumption would go right back. And if we put it on everything, the consumption of everything would go right back. But that isn't what happens. The effect of the sale that's happened is just you've changed when you buy something. It's not changed how much you're consuming. So people massively overestimate the effects of taxes on consumption because of these kinds of problems.
It almost sounds like the idea of shops selling alcohol cheaply as a loss leader, because it's so heavily taxed, that actually you can get people into your shop to buy the stuff cheaply if you decide to have it as a loss leader. And you're saying that sugary drinks would be the same kind of candidate for that kind of strategy?
Well, you can do that with anything that's really storable and popular and durable, right? So a case of Coke you can put in the cupboard and it'll last for months. Same thing with, well, at least spirits. Wine can get better with age, but maybe not the bargain basement end of it. You can't do that with vegetables.
So, however, if all sugary. Well, let's I go back to my argument of carbohydrates. If we could do that, and now maybe it's I'm being impractical here and thinking that we could, but I want to capture all that,
sure.
all carbohydrates, because I think otherwise you are going to have that problem of, all right, well, I'll just go for that super sweet fruit juice. But actually, if I drink too much of that, I'm going to end up with the same problem.
Sure.
If you are going to levy carbohydrates in such a way, then it's going to also send a signal to people who produce the food that they produce food with less carbohydrates. Because you think about the number of things that often have a lot of sugar added that really, I don't know if you really need them. Tomato sauce or peanut butter. You know, you don't maybe need, you don't need so much. Now, companies possibly do that because it's so cheap to do that. It's a cheap way of getting people to buy the stuff. But if it became more expensive, they'd think of other ways of making a profit.
Well, companies would reoptimize if the cost of their ingredients changed. So if tomatoes, if there were a bad growing season and the cost of tomatoes went up, then people would change around their recipes, and the same thing can happen with price changes. But that gets to a couple of points. So one of them is, what's the fundamental harm that you're trying to address here? Is it that you don't really like what other people are consuming and that you want to make them consume things more like the kinds of things that you like purchasing and you're making that decision for them? Or do you think that they're really making mistakes that you can't educate out of them, right? There's a pretty strong tendency for people to assume that they know what's better for other people and that they can make better decisions than other people facing the kinds of constraints that they're facing and in the circumstances they're in. The other part of it is that you're right, you would need to have it a comprehensive tax across all the different sugars if you wanted it to have those kinds of effects. But people like to pretend that you can solve the world's problems by having a 10 or 20% tax on sugar. And then immediately when the UK goes to implement one, all of the anti-sugar campaigners say, well, that's never going to be enough on its own. We also have to implement some advertising bans and a bunch of other things at the same time for it to have any real effect. You don't really know where it's going to end. And people laugh about slippery slopes and say that, well, it's just scaremongering. But just look what happened in the UK. As soon as they launched the tax, there were calls for the next thing to be added in on top of it. And if it ever got proposed as one bundle all at the same time and people saw what was actually on the table, I think they'd shy back from it.
But it is a conservative government, a government which subscribes to the ideas of individual choice, that's made this decision.
Sure.
Well, why have they done that? Is it just politics? Oh, it is politics. Maybe they're getting advice saying, if you don't levy sugar, we're paying for a whole lot of stuff in our health system later on with this, if we don't reduce consumption of carbohydrates now.
Well, there's a mix of things going on there, too. So one kind of depressing finding out of some Dutch work was that actually, if you look at lifetime medical costs, it's healthy people that end up costing the public health system the most money because they tend to take a long time to die at an old age. So it takes a very long time. You've got costs over a long number of years. Less healthy people conveniently die earlier and with less recourse to the social security systems. Now, that's terrible, and we shouldn't be trying to encourage people to die early just because of the fiscal savings.
How robust, however, is that research? Yeah?
Well, it looks like it holds up in places that have any kind of strong pension system and a strong public health system. So it definitely holds up for smokers. That's been shown in lots of different studies. I've only seen it in one study on healthy versus overweight and obese people so far. The other part of it, soda taxes can just be politically appealing, right? Because they're a kind of a tax that you can levy that sound nice. They sound like you're not just doing it to try and get a pile more money for the government. And you'll have a bunch of doctors cheering for you. And people tend to like
and
doctors.
And dentists, I might
hear. Oh, and dentists, too.
Actually, the strongest voice I get on our program we regularly hear from is Murray Thompson, who talks about dentistry. You know. And he looks in people's mouths and sees what happens when they have too much sugar.
Oh, sure. You would not want to be sipping on the stuff constantly. And dentists who have to spend time looking in the mouths of kids whose parents have decided to stick soda in a baby bottle, it would be hard not to want to be doing something about it. But it's also, also hard to believe
you're making,
would do it.
I mean, how many kids decide to put soda in a baby bottle?
Well, I'm not quite sure how you end up with a bunch of baby teeth rotted out in a two-year-old otherwise.
Yeah.
But that's not the kind of problem that you're going to solve with a tax, or certainly not a tax around 10%.
But that's not going to be the common. That's not the norm.
Oh, sure, not that isn't the
norm.
But it's those kinds of.
And
you've got
to be careful as a libertarian, maybe not to take the extreme case and say that's the norm.
No, but it's the kind of case that if you're dealing with the worst cases, because you're a surgeon who has to deal with those, they're the ones that come to mind for you, and you're basing your policy recommendations on your experience with those kinds of worst cases. And it's the same thing with emergency room doctors and their views on alcohol, right? They're seeing some of the worst cases. They're not really seeing the moderate drinkers who never come into the emergency room because they've behaved themselves. They're seeing the worst cases, and they're thinking about those when they're talking about policy.
The Conservative government idea, it's still a proposal. Well, it's a plan. It hasn't happened yet. Give me an example of a country where there has been a levy on sugar, and from your point of view, the result of that levy.
Sure. The most recent country that's put it in that we've got some evidence on is Mexico. That's been largely represented in the press as a 10% tax on soda, but that's not quite right. It is a peso per liter. And one of the silly things that they had in there is a 1 peso per liter, no matter how sugary the drink was. So you might expect that in the fullness of time, manufacturers will figure out how to make soda concentrate. That'll still just attract the peso per liter tax.
And it's only on soda drinks?
Sugar sweetened beverages, excluding alcohol ones, and I believe also excluding milk-based ones. But one of the neat things in there was, well, there are a whole pile of empirical problems in the statistics that they use, but I'm not going to get into those here. But even if we take them at face value, the effects were really concentrated in the poorest households. Now, then we have to think about what's a peso for one of the poorest households in their sample. And if you look at it relative to the daily wage earned by those folks, it's 1.7%. If you turn that into New Zealand comparable figures, if you're working full-time on the minimum wage, you're talking about a $2 per liter excise tax on soda. If we're wanting to have similar kinds of effects on poor households, nobody's talking about a $2 per liter tax here.
And it is just for sodas, soda drinks,
soda, sugar-sweetened beverages, but they also have tax on other kinds of sugary solids. So there can...
Such as? A limited range? Because again, we come up with a problem.
Chocolate bars and junk foods. Yeah, they also track the sugar tax, but it's lower in magnitude than the soda tax. So if you were to buy a bag of sugar and make your own lemonade at home, you'd be paying far less excise than if you were buying comparable quantities of soda.
How long has that levy been in place?
It's only been in place since 2014, really.
So it's difficult to start measuring yet whether there's been any benefit or any change in the amount of obesity or diabetes or anything like that.
Well, the effects that they found in the first year, and the longer things go, the harder it is to distinguish time effects from the effects of the tax, really. But in the first year, they were finding that the effects on the poorest households were comparable to about 600 liters less consumed in poor households every 16 days or so. So ballpark, a liter less a month. It's not that huge an effect.
Right. Not enough, you would say, to justify the levy.
It depends what you mean by justify, right?
Yeah.
So it's not something that seems all that effective on its own grounds. If you think that the government should be combating obesity, there hasn't been a link yet between that change in consumption and obesity outcomes. But there's still the broader picture of why is this any of the government's business in the first place?
There seems to be this perverse, I would describe it as perverse development in with modern humanity, in that if you live in a relatively poor economy, then you are poor, then the threat to you is not having enough food, full stop. If you're relatively poor in a Western economy now, the threat to you is that you will become unhealthy because you will become obese. Is there evidence, however, that poorer people tend to choose unhealthy food and drink in countries like New Zealand?
Well, obesity is strongly correlated with poverty, and some of that will be due to different nutritional choices, also differences in exercise. So sedentary lifestyles will be more common among poorer cohorts. Richer people can afford to go out and do more exercise and put a little bit more priority on it. So it'll be a mix between nutrition and exercise. But it's not... It can't just be the cost of different food items. A lot of it will be coming out of takeaways, but it's still cheaper to make food at home than it is to buy takeaways, or at least I've always found so.
When you at the New Zealand Initiative look at this whole issue, do you think there is a problem? Or do you think, perversely, with that Dutch study, that, hey, there's not a problem to the nation because people who aren't so well are cheaper for the state?
I don't think that we should be judging whether we should be implementing policies based on people's costs to the state in that kind of a measure. That would be encouraging people to slip their wrists just before they go on the pension, and that would just be abhorrent. Instead, we should be looking at whether people are making decisions that are right for them as they see it and not really presume to make those decisions for them. I'm not living in other people's circumstances. I don't trust myself to make those judgments for them. If we've provided information to them about what the effects of different kinds of diets are or different ways of having dinner, and they've decided that they prefer one thing over another and it's not what I would choose, how can I say that that's wrong?
Given then that you and I think both share a pretty middle class upbringing, and the role models in my life always are about taking care of oneself, both in terms of what I ate and also how I look after myself. Mm-hmm. Why is it that poorer people often appear to make decisions which in the medium to long term are not good for their survival or even just their general standard of living and enjoyment of life?
Well, people will respond to their circumstances and the constraints that they face. If you expect that you're going to have a shorter life expectancy anyway, then the cost of making unhealthy decisions are lower because there's less harm, right? So if we look in some of the latest work in the U.S., there's a reasonably strong income gradient in life expectancy. Poorer people expect to live longer, less long anyway. So the benefits of exercise aren't quite as strong. Perhaps it'd be one reason. Other reasons could be that after a miserable day, if you've not had other things that have made the day good for you, something sweet can be a nice pickup.
Which is true of me too. Sure. And my son and lots of people I know, yes, a healthy, sweet pickup, a chocolate brownie. And I have it at the moment, a little problem with snacking when I get home. I ride up a hill on the bike, but then I'm a bit peckish. But on the whole, I'd say that I'm still doing things to compensate for that. I'm aware of the risks involved with that. Somebody suggested that we should tax obesity itself.
Oh, that is a fun one. Yeah, that is a piece by Catherine Rempel in the Washington Post a little
while
back.
Was she being
serious? Well, I think that she was mostly trying to point out the absurdity of some of the soda tax arguments. So come the end of her article, she'd said, first she'd proposed just an obesity tax directly if you buy the argument that people should be taxed based on their cost to the government, and obesity, if it did result in higher cost to the government, then just tax it directly, have a national weigh-in day, maybe when you go in to fill in your taxes and you've got an additional tax based on how heavy you are, your BMI. But what she did come to at the end was saying that, well, if we think that obese people can't really change that and that it'd be unfair to tax them that way, why do we think that putting a tax on soda would change things anyway, right? If you can't change your BMI through things that you could affect personally because you're trying to avoid the tax, why would changing soda consumption through a soda tax be a desirable thing? So that was a bit of the dilemma that she put up. On the government side, well, if people don't change their behavior that much, it just makes the tax revenues higher, so that's not such a bad thing on their side.
You know, schools often sell in tuck shops, as we used to call them, and they probably still called tuck shops now, sell stuff that was full of sugar. And mm-hmm. then there might be attempts to limit that, but the school then says, but hang on, that's one of the ways we make money, to fund things on the school, because we know if we sell sweet stuff to the kids, they will buy it.
Well, it could be fun to ask the kids themselves what they think on that, too. Last year, the initiative hosts a series of high school debates where some of the top university debaters around the country do some preliminary heats in the high schools, presenting their arguments there before
they talk about things like diet?
Well, we had a debate there about whether the school tuck shop should be banned from selling sweet things. And after hearing the best arguments from both sides on it presented, they said that they really didn't want to have it banned in their school tuck shop.
I was thinking of another possible solution, and that is to have more emphasis in terms of home economics, even before high school,
sure,
on kids learning how to cook for themselves in a healthy way that's cheap. And you know what? Maybe even as an incentive, sell that stuff at the tuck shop so they also get an incentive to learn how they can make money by making this stuff.
Well, that starts getting into the kind of solution that I like to hear more about. So you can totally imagine a pilot program where high school or middle school kids are taught as part of home ec how to make a nutritious meal for the family on a limited budget with the kinds of cooking resources that are available in lower decile households the mix of pots and pans that are really in those households, you're not going to have a fancy wok. Find something that's relevant, that works, and then have a homework assignment. Well, make that meal for your family and show them how to do it too. Test to see whether it has any effect. I don't know whether it would, but it seems the kind of thing that's worth trying, because at least it's respecting people's preferences. You're showing them how to do something, and then if they choose not to, well, you know that they know what they're getting into, right? They've been shown one way. If they don't want to do that, why shouldn't that be up to them?
Well, it's one of the reasons, this last question, because we're running out of time, one of the reasons that because they make these bad decisions because there's a safety net there in terms of a health system.
Well, that seems pretty unlikely. The amount of, if you look across obesity increases in the United States compared to here, you've got private health care in the U.S. largely. New Zealand is largely a public health care system. They've both seen increases in obesity. It's been more of a worldwide trend. You don't really see effects of the existence of a public health system on people deciding to eat an unhealthy diet, or at least I've not seen any studies showing that yet. It'd be a really interesting one if people did find that, though.
Eric, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative, back with some more largely libertarian thoughts in a couple of months.